All right, everybody, welcome back to the Mindful Hunter podcast. I'm your host, as always, Jay Nickel, and we are here with Stephen Drake. You probably already all know who he is, but a very well-known photographer, hunter, videographer, vlogger in his own right. I will make sure to put links to all his stuff down in the bottom. He's also, you know, as far as a content creator, one of my big inspirations, because he's one of the rare guys who's able to put out polished content that still comes across as authentic and not overproduced. And I gotta have a lot of respect for kind of his style and the way he puts together stuff. So big pleasure and honor for me today. So I said it once, but thank you again, man, for taking the time. I greatly appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks, Jay. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Okay. So let's start a little bit. Like, I know you're a Montana guy now, but where are you from originally? Where did you grow up? And when does hunting become, you know, a substantial part of your life?
Yeah. So currently I live in Bozeman, Montana, and I've been here the last, 10 years, I guess. And prior to that, I grew up in Helena, Montana, which is only 2 hours from here. Okay. So born and raised and stayed in Montana. So, and then from an early on age, I mean, I started bird hunting with my dad, and okay. He would just take me out. It was primarily upland bird, a little bit of waterfowl. And it wasn't until I think I was like 14 years old, and him and I were, I was in the back of a truck, and we're just driving up this dirt road in the dark. There's this big thunderstorm. There's these big looming clouds. There's lightning happening. And all of a sudden I turn and look. So I'm like standing in the bed of the truck, and I look ahead of me, and there's sparks flying like right off the road. And I'm like, what the heck is that? And then in the headlights, these two big giant bull elk ran in front of the road, right in front of the truck. And they had jumped a barbed wire fence, and they had actually broke the two top wires, and they sparked. And it was such a vivid memory for me. It was kind of frightening, actually, just because the ambiance of the whole evening and the day was just kind of spooky. And then to see these giant creatures that, you know, in a flash of a second in front of the truck, I mean, they looked like 2,000 pound animals, and they're not quite that big, but they were pretty big. So that was kind of like my very first like memory of like seeing an elk, or like kind of getting that, like that curiosity of like, what the heck is this thing? And then, you know, kind of eventually started going down the rabbit hole of starting to hunt elk. And I grew up hunting elk primarily with my parents.
Okay.
And we would just go out on weekends, and we didn't know what we were doing. We had a little like hoochie mama squeeze elk call. My dad would, you know, he'd be 20 yards behind me. He's like, well, the internet, or actually this was kind of pre-internet, but like some of the local sporting goods stores, you know, we would learn how to call elk. And it was just like, yeah, just set up with the caller 20 yards behind you and squeeze on that hoochie mama, and maybe some elk will come in. And it actually worked quite well. I don't know if that hoochie mama works as well now. I think the elk have kind of caught on to it a bit.
Do you think that's true? Do you think they get kind of called out of certain things?
I do. And I wouldn't necessarily say it's from personal experience, but like my hunting tactic is I don't call. Like, and part of that is because I hunt alone almost entirely, at least for elk. And at least on most of my personal hunts, it's just alone. And when you're hunting alone and trying to call in an elk, it's really hard, because it's like, you got to call. And then right when the elk maybe is coming in, then you got to like move really quick and try to like trick the elk to think that, oh, that sound is coming from back here, when you, the shooter, are actually up here. When you have a caller and a shooter, you know, the caller can stay back here, shooter here, and then the elk comes running in. So it's really hard to call elk when you're by yourself. I also feel like, yeah, I guess I have seen elk that maybe get call shy, or I'll hunt areas where I'm just like, I'm not going to make a sound because these elk know what's up. Instead, I'm just going to be super stealthy. I'm going to try to chase bugles and just cut bulls off as they're moving between their bedding and feeding areas. So that, in a nutshell, that has been my hunting tactic. But I'm married now, though, and my wife loves to hunt elk with me, and so she's getting a little fairly trained up with the elk calls and vice versa. So it's really fun for her and I to go out and kind of have these interactions with critters. So I also believe that, at least in my experience, I can't call in the big mature, like the herd bull.
Right.
The herd bull, he's always got his harem of cows. He doesn't want anything to do with anybody. So if you're making noise, often, again, in my experience, that bull will grab his cows and just leave. And so it's like, well, what might be better is to just be completely silent. Don't let anybody know that there's anything there, and then just try to get into the mix and hope that the elk makes a mistake and comes within bow range. So,
yeah, I can definitely echo the same sentiments. And the one time I did have luck calling in a bull and killing him with my bow solo, the terrain was extremely favorable. Like, picture kind of like two ridges running down like this with a bowl in the middle, and he was held up on the face of the far bowl, and I'm up on this ridge, and I was actually bugling down into him, and he was just holding up, which further supports another one of your opinions. Like, sometimes I think our calling is actually giving the inappropriate messages. Like, I think I sounded bigger than him at the time. Like, he was a 6-point, but he wasn't a big giant 6-point. And I think my calling would maybe have been too aggressive. I'm not a great caller by any stretch of the imagination. But when I threw some cow calls kind of back over the other side of the ridge, he came in instantly. But if those terrain features hadn't have been so favorable, like the fact that I could stand in the same place and locate my, just by, you know, covering my mouth and locating it back off that ridge, those cows probably sounded like they were coming from 150 yards away, kind of behind me from his line of sight. And that's the only luck I've personally ever had calling them in. But yeah, you see, you hear people say, like, those real classic calls. I hear the same thing about the Primos Terminator bugle and the Hoochie Mama. But it was funny when you go up to like Northern BC here, which is like, there's a lot of elk hunting, but it's like really old school elk hunting. And there's still dudes who are like, you know, wearing Carhartts and Mac jackets that are like recommending, yeah, you get a Hoochie Mama. It's kind of funny that it's more, I think part of it is also, it's just not a trendy, it's not a cool, you don't have to have lots of skill. There's not a bunch of videos yeah. to make about it. You know what I mean? Like, it's just a simple little tool that you give the thing a squeeze. And I think there's still some old dudes in some little corners having real good luck with just classic tactics like that.
Totally. And I mean, part of my early on days of elk hunting, especially, I mean, I absolutely love the interaction. I think that's probably the biggest allure of archery elk hunting anyway, is that interaction, is hearing a bugle, like interacting with those either individual animals or herds of animals. And back to like my kind of intro story, if you may.
Yeah.
That's kind of like, bird hunting is how I got into it. And then I got into elk hunting kind of just by like, kind of this curiosity factor. And then, so again, I grew up in Helena. And then when I went to college, I came to Bozeman, which is only 2 hours away. And just because of the physical distance, I mean, it was only 2 hours, but I just wasn't able to really hunt with my parents anymore. And you know, my college schedule, I'd get like weekdays off, and like, they obviously wouldn't get weekdays off. And I quickly learned that, weekday hunting can be pretty good, because most of the time there's just weekend warriors that are hunting hills. So anyway, that's when I picked up a camera, and my whole goal was to basically share these and capture and share these cool experiences, that I was getting, you know, that I was having in the elk woods. And about the same time Instagram started, Facebook started, then Instagram, and being in Bozeman's kind of like this weird hub for outdoor and hunting brands, and it's become even more so.
So it was even like that 10 years ago or when you first got there, because I'm aware of that, but I also wasn't sure how recent of a phenomenon that was.
Yeah. So, I mean, Sims has been, like, fishing has been here for a long time. Mystery Ranch Backpacks has been here for forever. In, I think it was 2008 or 2009, Sitka moved to Bozeman. They used to be based in California, and that just wasn't a fitting location for the type of business that Sitka is. So they've moved here. And then after that, I mean, there's, you know, who else?
Well, Stone Glacier's there, right?
Yeah, that's right. Stone Glacier's in Bozeman. Yeah. The whole
Meat Eater crew is all there now. So they've got, I don't know, is the FHF office? I think Phelps is still over in Washington, but I think the FHF got Rick or whatever his name is. I think he's in Bozeman.
Yeah, FHF is in Bozeman. And there's just like, there's so many.
Yeah,
it's,
yeah.
It's a great location, really. But so anyway, yeah, it was kind of, for me, it was like social media started. I started posting and being in Bozeman, and I like instantly got connected with a couple cool brands. Sick of being one of them. And, you know, basically it was, yeah, it was, so it was good timing. And what I was photographing and what I was sharing was, I guess it was groundbreaking at the time. I didn't think anything of it. I just thought, I was like, oh, I'm just like sharing these cool, authentic experiences that I'm having in the woods. And let me preface all this by saying, so I grew up skiing and like ski racing and doing a lot of backcountry skiing. And I really thrive in the mountains, and I love going to the mountains and experiencing just wild places, wild weather, and, you know, putting yourself really outside of your comfort zone. And so what I was sharing on my social media and whatnot through photography kind of was that. It wasn't just like your stereotypical guy smiling with an animal that you've harvested. Right. It was like everything that went along to get to that point. And, one analogy I use, and this is something I very much implement in my own work as a photographer. So in 2011, I drew an elk tag in Montana, and like a special elk tag. And I spent 45 days hunting before I finally killed an elk. And so the kill, or like the classic trophy photos, like that was 1/45th of the entire experience of that right. hunt. And so to me, that's kind of like the perfect framework to like be like, okay, like what else is hunting? It's not just this tiny little end result. Like, yes, that is our ultimate goal when we're out there, is we want to be successful and harvest an animal. But it's like, there's so many crazy, cool things that happen along the way. And that's kind of what I have always been trying to capture, and what I've been focused on as a professional photographer and videographer now. So
I think that's one of the reasons that your content speaks so directly to me. Like I try and make what I consider somewhat decent hunt films. And I think if you add them up now, I have more unsuccessful ones than successful ones, but I added it up the other day and I have more views collectively on my unsuccessful hunts than I do on my successful hunts. And I was actually like, I find that really encouraging, because the thing that's always been the priority to me is that like, I'm trying to tell the story of adventure. Like my whole, you know, inspiration was I killed my first backcountry animal and I was trying to tell people about it, and like words were failing me, and I'm actually a fairly articulate guy, but I was incapable of expressing verbally what this story was like. And I thought, I think video is the only thing that's going to be able to do this. And then it turned out that I think what people find almost more interesting is like the challenge and the solitude and the story and the narrative of, like, you know, in the classic literature thing, there's three types of challenge, right? Man against nature, man against man, and man against self. And I think you go out on a hunt and it, like, all three of those things are instantly, you don't have to do anything other than put your boots on and start walking away from the truck, and you're guaranteed to find those three challenges. And I think when you're not solely focused on a grip and grin or stacking bodies, and you're focused more on like documenting the story as it unfolds, there's just so much interesting stuff that, like, people hit me up all the time and it's like, well, do you storyboard or do you script or do you, and it's like, no, I don't worry about any of that kind of stuff. I just make sure the camera's handy, because if I'm out there, weird shit's just gonna happen that's gonna be interesting, you know what I mean? But I think your style in particular has really showcased that. And especially with like a lot of the vlog series, like there's a lot of the vlog series that are like pretty, I don't want to use like a word with negative connotation, like regular or mundane or black. They're not, it's not crazy stuff. Like you've got the whole every hunt or every, what's that one's called? I don't want to say every man's hunt, because now I'm calling
anyone's hunt. Yeah.
Anyone's hunt.
That was a potential name for it. So
yeah, and I can see why in this day and age it didn't get picked. Yeah. Yeah, but it's content like that that is not particularly far out of reach for people. Like, it's attainable, you know? Yeah. And it doesn't, because not everybody, like, if you look at regular people aren't going out there and killing giant animals every year. And I think when they see a lot of these personalities doing that, they find it hard to relate to that. But when they see, like, the stories and the camping and the interesting stuff and the cooking and the, that is very attainable and relatable to a lot of people.
Yeah, for sure. I always laugh because talking about the relatability and whatnot. And this is more happened so maybe in the last like two to four years is like, so I do a lot of work for brands, yeah. Sitka, Matthews, Yeti, you know, a number of other ones as well. And what they want more of. So like I got into it as a photographer. And to me, like photography is also an art, but it's a ability, or it's a avenue and a tool to allow you to capture these cool, authentic moments. But lately they still want photography, but they also want just like really cool clips, really cool moments that you capture with your phone.
Right.
And, you know, partly because, you know, we've got social media platforms like Instagram where it's like vertical videos do well, but also, you know, everybody has a phone.
Right.
Or most everybody has a phone probably. And it's like, it's a very attainable thing for people to, you know, film stuff with their iPhone. So there's like this level of like, oh, even though professional photographer, you know, whatever captured this clip, it's like, oh, I could do that too. He just filmed it with his phone, like no big thing. So there's been a huge like increase in need and desire from these people that I work with to capture more of that. So
did you see that series Peter McKinnon did comparing like hyper produced reels and shorts with like real basic phone stuff?
Yeah.
It was very interesting. And I come from a music production background. And what's really funny is that when you digitally produce music, you actually have to insert like noise and artifacts back into it. Because if you don't, it sounds too clean. And it actually like grates on people's ears. So you have like fake analog compressors and tube compressors and all this stuff that's really just algorithms that's putting noise and distortion back into the music because our brain is so used to hearing that, and even genetically, right? Because that's been in music since the beginning of music, that we find it uncomfortably when it's too clean. And I always try and think the same thing about video, because film is the same way. When you post like a hyper crisp photo, like there's almost something a little jarring about it. And video is the same way. And I think by making it a little bit noisy and making a little bit of grain in there, and by introducing like a little bit of dirt and a little bit of grit, or just using your phone instead of your, you know, A1 or, you know, whatever, you know, camera you have at your disposal, I think it actually makes it in a way more pleasing in some ways to the audience.
Yeah, for sure. My iPhone here is arguably my most used camera these days, which I totally get it, but I don't like it.
Yeah. I still have a hard time. I love lots of data, especially when you go to edit stuff. Cause I think that's for me where it kind of falls apart. Cause when you go to start to like color grade or edit something that was taken with a really small, chip, there's not a whole lot you can do with it. Where when you have like a full frame sensor, it's like, or 10 bit data video, like you can push things so far and do so much with it that like, and I think I almost love like post-processing and editing in some ways more than the actual capturing of it. And that, so that kind of takes away some of the fun. Okay. So let's get back on track here. So you're in college. You feel naturally drawn towards capturing these stories and sharing them. And then at some point you recognize the opportunity for some form of commercial interest. How does that happen? Does somebody reach out to you? Do you reach out to somebody? What's that chain of events look like?
Yeah. So, I mean, I wish I could say that it was this like planned out like thing, right, that I was like, this is what I want to do in my life. It wasn't that at all. So when I was in college, like I was fairly new to elk hunting, and I loved hunting and I loved skiing. And so hunting and skiing were my primary focuses in college. I mean, I did all right in class and coursework and whatnot, but it's like,
what did you take, by the way?
Well, so when I became a junior, my advisor, she like called me and she's like, hey, like if you want to graduate anytime in the next 2 to 5 years, like you should just pick a major and just stick with it, even if it doesn't have anything to do with what you maybe want to do. And so she's like, well, it looks like you have the most, you know, courses in like taken in just like a general business degree.
Okay.
So she's like, well, if you do this, you'll graduate in another year and a half. I was like, sweet, let's do that. And so yeah, I got a general business marketing degree, which is fine. I mean, it's a good all around degree for sure. Talking about the value of college for like moving forward, that's a total rabbit hole. I don't want to get into that, but I don't really remember anything that I learned in college, but the thing that was super valuable for me was the networking.
Right.
And so being in Bozeman, taking a business class, I met these people. So I met this one individual that he actually worked at Mystery Ranch Backpacks, and him and it was funny. He came and just gave a quick presentation to one of my business. It was like a business 101 class. And I was the only hunter in the whole class, and he was a hunter too. So him and I we hit it off, and we just stayed in touch over the next, I think, year or 6 months. And eventually he helped me get a job at Mystery Ranch. And, you know, he was the only hunter, and then it was me. And so kind of through my photography, like he basically gave me or Mystery Ranch gave me a platform to share my work on.
Okay.
And then again, because of that networking opportunity, there'd be like Sitka reached out and said, hey, like, would you be willing to come on? And so interesting story about that. So yeah, Sitka reached out and said, hey, we love what you're doing. You're sharing hunting in this cool, unique way that we just haven't seen. And then they invited me. They're like, hey, do you want to go down to SHOT Show, which is in Vegas? SHOT Show, it's shooting, hunting, outdoor trade show. It's basically the biggest hunting, shooting trade show probably in the world.
And invite only, right? Like you got to go as part of a brand. You just can't go like, I couldn't just buy a ticket and show up to SHOT Show.
Right. Yeah. So it's not a public show. So, right. So they invite me to go down there just for like 24 hours. So I just turned 21. This was my first time going to Vegas. So I don't think I slept the whole time, but either way, go down to SHOT Show and get there. And I meet all these sick of people and there was, I think there was like four other like kind of up and coming photographers, and Sitka gets us together and they say like, hey, why, like the reason we want to have you down here is because we want you to look at the hunting industry as a whole, because like the core of the hunting industry is at SHOT Show. And they said, we want you to see how hunting is being represented. And they kind of left it at that. So we're like, okay, it's like, well, you know, I was only 21. So I knew what hunting was to me, but I knew way less than I do now. But so anyway, so walk into this trade show and I could be off on my numbers, but I think there's like 60,000 people a day that go through SHOT Show. You have to check that. But it's absolutely insane. You walk around and there's just thousands and thousands and thousands of people. It's absolutely insane. But I have this vivid memory when I walk into SHOT Show, it's like this big giant open trade show area. And there's this big banner up, probably 40 feet wide and 15 feet tall. And it's this guy, and he's holding this big giant, I mean, it literally probably a 300-inch white-tailed deer. And it's, I think it had an ear tag. And in the background, it's kind of blurred out. It's like shot on a low aperture, but there looks like a big old fence.
Right.
And I was just like, huh. And I was only 21. I didn't maybe have the foresight that I do now, but I looked at that. I was like, well, that's kind of weird. That's got to be a high fence, like, you know, given hunt. And I was just like, that's weird. And then the guy that was holding he wasn't smiling. He was just had this like, kind of like smug, stern look on his face. And you're just like, okay, weird. So I'll proceed to walk around the show for the rest of the day. And man, like hunting was, I mean, all the photos were of trophy shots. And again, nothing against a trophy shot. I just think that you're leaving out so much more, and maybe the more impactful portions of the hunt or portions of the hunt that maybe connect better with people that either don't hunt or even people that do hunt. Like I was just like, where's everything else? Because it was all just photos of people like posing with dead things, and they weren't even classy photos either. They were like bloody and gory and tongues hanging out. And so anyway, so fast forward a month or whatever, and have another follow-up meeting with Sitka, and they're like, well, yeah, what'd you think? And I, you know, told them my first impressions, and Sitka's like, yeah, like we're pretty worried about how hunting is being represented in this space. And we're worried that, and you could say this even more so now, this was back in 2011, but they were like, we're worried that
this is pretty progressive at the time, man. I'm pretty surprised to even be hearing this conversation. This is really interesting.
Yeah, super progressive. So they're like, we're legit worried that the way that hunting is being represented, like we're gonna lose hunting. Hunting is gonna get voted away. And I mean, I still think that hunting could get voted away, but it's like, it's like, so Sitka was arguably the first brand to make a stance, and they were like, we're gonna change the face of hunting. We're gonna like do some progressive things and just basically share the whole experience of the hunt and try to maybe get people that are hunting curious or on the fence to, you know, adopt hunting or just like view hunting in maybe a different way. And it's kind of wild, you know, so it's 2023 now. So fast forward or 12, 13 years. And it's like almost every brand has, I mean, it's changed significantly. Like what you used to see, which was primarily trophy shots, is now it's all about the experience.
Look at the Sitka film that just dropped with Rachel Attila and her dad. I mean, that is a prime example of stuff that has nothing to do with those types of images. You were like, that's all. I would argue the kill is like a single digit percentage point in that, in the gross value of that film as a whole of the message it's trying to communicate.
Totally. It's like sharing these, you know, these human stories as well as just these stories,
right.
You know, man versus nature, themselves, whatever. It's just like these like struggles that we all face in probably any walk of life, but that we very much face in hunting. I mean, that's what I love to do. And that's why it ended up being a great fit with Sitka. And that was kind of their mission, if you may. And I would say they've succeeded in that for sure. And I think we will probably forever still fight for hunting and our ability to hunt. And I don't know if it's up to us to change viewpoints, but I certainly think that we can all do a better job or just be mindful about the type of content that we post and we put out online. Social media is so crazy because, like, unless you have a private profile, if you've got a public profile, I mean, anyone from anywhere in the world, as long as they've got Instagram, can technically like see your stuff. And so that could be really good. That could also be really bad and detrimental, especially to something that's maybe at times controversial, like hunting. So yeah, I just think we need to be really mindful about what we post.
Yeah, I agree. I just went on a bit of a rant about this the other day too, because I got asked a question on a Q&A podcast I did. So my day job, I'm a business consultant, and technically we focus on behavioral strategy. And we got hired by one of the conservation organizations, this is probably 3 years ago now, whose primary mission is shifting sentiment in non-hunting individuals, which I think is probably one of the areas where we need to focus most of our attention moving forward. Because the example I give is, let's just say for the sake of round numbers, 5% of North America hunts. Okay. If we increase that by 20%, which would be insane, we're now at 6% of North America hunting. So, which is nothing still when we, like, it's still zero voting power. It's still zero power in numbers. Like, we're still outnumbered 94-6. But if instead we focus, and we kind of coined this term when we did this work with them, non-hunting outdoor enthusiasts. So these are your rock climbers, your mountain bikers, your campers, your kayakers, who, other than the actual killing of an animal, have an unbelievable amount in common with us, like a love of wild places, a need for really large, untouched space, a need for access points, a need for, like, all these things that they care about, we care about as well. The only difference is we also like to go in there and hunt some animals in these same type of places. And I believe it's a tricky line because I don't want to give up who I am. Like, I do still think it's important to be honest that I'm a hunter and I hunt and I kill things. And that's a fact of the matter. I don't want to change my whole vernacular, and I don't want to kind of soft sell something and lose who the heart of being a hunter is. But I also firmly believe that if we are not actively engaging with those non-hunting outdoor enthusiasts to try and build allies and create a cohort and create like bonds and, like, you know, with other stakeholder groups, I think that's the best hope we have moving forward, because you could be addressing another 20, 30, or 40% of the North American population by creating relationships with those groups that you will never get anywhere close to by just trying to create more hunters.
Yeah. Preach.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it was funny. I said all that and I thought people were, the actual question came down to somebody asked if I would ever consult for one of the organizations. I'm like, well, actually I did. And unfortunately they took everything we did and they just put it on a shelf, which is what a lot of these organizations who kind of like the old boys club. And it's like, I work for some pretty large Fortune 500 organizations that take my opinions pretty seriously. And then there's these little conservation groups that won't listen to like what really high quality academic peer reviewed research. And it was like, I was like, after that, I'm like, no, I'm not going to waste my time again. Like, because this stuff's too good. And if you're just going to sit it on a shelf, but like, that's the point of frustration I'm at right now is that we have the tools at our disposal to be doing a better job, but there's still this friction between like the older demographic in the industry that like doesn't want to budge and doesn't want to change the way that they're doing stuff. And if we don't, we're just showing up with a knife to a gunfight because the anti-hunting organizations are using cutting edge behavioral research. They've got tons of money behind them and we're just not showing up with the same tools to those fights. And that's something that concerns me long-term. If we're not able to shift the tide on that, it could present difficulties further down the road, I believe.
Yeah. Yeah. No doubt. I see that often as well. And I'm not super knowledgeable on this, but I like, in the lower 48 in Montana, I mean, hunting is very quite well supported compared to probably BC. And I've heard some wild things that maybe are happening in your neck of the woods we've got like the Pittman Robertson Act here and so much of the money that hunting and shooting creates, like that actually goes back into government for the sake of managing wild places, hiring biologists, all this stuff. But it's like, I think BC doesn't have anything like that. And so it's like, no. that's a hard, like where do you go from there?
Well, we also, one of the things that I've also been preaching for a long time, one of the things I like about what the states tend to do is they approach things from a very business centric perspective. And like, I just went and bought my tags for the year. I think it cost me $300 and I got like 15 tags. I'm like, this is not right. I should not be able to buy two black bear tags, an elk tag, a sheep tag, a goat tag. Like somebody needs to be charging more money for this because this is insane that they're like $20 and $40 a piece. And you're hunting like animals that you can count the amount of places on the earth that you can hunt these things over the counter on one hand. And you wonder why we don't have, our wildlife management doesn't have the resources that it needs to do the appropriate job. Anyway, I could ramble about this stuff all day, but I think everyone would agree that if we want to keep enjoying the type of privileges that we have, we cannot be complacent because they are at the wolves are at the door. Pardon the mixed metaphor and the pun, but there's definitely things to be concerned about. So back to your story, I find it interesting that you are kind of almost part of this cohort that was like at a renaissance in the, I don't even know what you would call it, but like the documentation of hunting. Like that was a really special time, like that period 10 years ago, because I think of guys like, and I'm going to name BC guys because it's just who I know, but I think of guys like you, I think of guys like Connor, I think of guys like Adam Foss, and like you kind of all had like came from different places, but all had similar trajectories kind of at the same time and all communicate similar messages, albeit in unique ways with your imagery. How important do you think that was in the opportunities you had, like right time, right place type of thing?
Yeah. I mean, I think it was all right place, right time for sure. So me being in Bozeman and then working at Mystery Ranch, and then I ended up working for this creative agency in Bozeman. And Adam Foss worked there. There's like three guys that now work at Sitka that worked there. Connor Gavitt didn't work there, but I later met Connor on a hunt. And it was just like, basically there was 12 guys in their young to mid 20s that all worked in this one same office. We all loved to hunt. We were all fairly skilled with cameras, and we just, most of us were single, and we're just like, let's just go have big wild adventures and document and film it. And yeah, since then, like almost everybody that worked at that agency now does more or less the same thing, but in different roles or different businesses, but primarily in the hunting space. So that was pretty huge for sure.
Now, one of the things I'm interested in is that, like, if I look back over your career, and I don't know if this was intentional, and you can tell me if I'm reading too much into this, but there seemed to be a transition from when you were like, there's obviously transition from like an employee kind of photographer to more of a freelance photographer when you're working with multiple clients. But then the main transition that I'm interested in is this more transition to like Stephen Drake as the brand, where you are, and I don't want to use that in a tacky way, but like the vlog series, and it's more about, and I also see it as an opportunity because you're actually bringing more to a brand at that point when you're bringing your own kind of social media presence as well as your ability to capture and deliver content that they can use on their own platforms. But was that transition to creating your own, you know, again, for lack of a better word, brand or online identity, was that intentional? Did that happen as a result of kind of some external influences? Was that just a matter of evolving with the times? Because that seems to be what was happening on social media at the time. I'd be interested in hearing about that evolution.
Yeah. So I started vlogging on YouTube, gosh, I don't know, I think like 6 or 7 years ago now. I don't know, time runs together. But when I started it, it was literally just because I was like, oh, I know how to do video. I feel like I'm decently skilled at video. And I had just been doing photography, and I was kind of looking for my, like, a creative outlet to just kind of showcase a little bit more of my video work, as well as just like better capture and document some of the trips and things that I do. Just because, I don't know, if you don't capture it, if you don't film it, it kind of goes in one ear and out the other, and you just kind of forget about it. So it wasn't, yeah. It was for me, it was really just about like just more creative exploration and just kind of something to do. I definitely wasn't bored with photography. I just saw, I was like, oh my gosh, video is so fun. To me, you can tell sometimes deeper stories with video. And I was like, I'm always doing cool stuff or unique stuff. And, I guess Casey Neistat on YouTube, he was doing daily vlogs, and I was looking at his vlogs, and I'm just like, my God, like a guy that lives in downtown New York City, which to me sounds awful, but it's just like his life was so interesting, and yet the subject matter was just like doing life in the city. And I was just like, well, that's kind of crazy. I was like, so anyway, I mean, I suppose that was maybe part of it, but it was more just like, oh, that's really cool. I want to do that too. It was never like, ooh, I want to do this and make money at it or become a influencer. It's so weird because like when I got into this, and my whole life I've been fairly introverted, and I've kind of had to learn to, like, I'm still very much an introverted person, but I've had to kind of learn to be more extroverted, learn to talk to people and do all these things. And so again, when I got into hunting, or maybe phrase it this way, probably my favorite thing about hunting is like that alone time. I love being out there when it's just me. Just like silence, and it's just you and nature and what happens, and you kind of have to rely on your own instincts to survive. And like, that's what I absolutely crave. And so I really don't actively like bringing other people into it. But with the camera, that was kind of a way for me to like not have somebody else there, but then also be able to kind of share and document kind of some of the things I was doing. So yeah, I started doing that, and I've never really gotten a whole lot of views on my vlog, but it has created a pile of different work opportunities from, you know, shooting other video projects around other people or other brands. And, you know, we talk about Instagram too. So again, when I started Instagram, I was like, I'm just sharing the cool photos and places that I go. That's all that it was. And I mean, now I've got like 50,000 followers, and it's weird because it's just like, again, I'm this super introverted person, and yet all these brands are like, hey, we really want to work with you, and like, we want you to just keep doing your thing, but like, use our products and we'll pay you. I'm just like, this is so weird. But I mean, whatever. Is what it is.
I can relate. You have no idea. And it's funny, I actually spent 10 years as a DJ, and everybody was always shocked because I was because I'm so introverted. And I kind of viewed like turntables the same way I view the camera. Like it's a way for me to like have this physical barrier between me and everybody else. And it's like, it's not that I don't want to engage with other people. I like making stuff and then like putting it out there and then having the back and forth with people about it. But it's like the live, like in person, one-on-one stuff, I find it's just not my favorite, man. Like I'm not, yeah, I'm much, that's why I focus so much on solo hunting. I'm struggling with it now because I almost feel like I have a responsibility to take some people hunting with me. And I'm like, I know I should be inviting somebody out on Friday, but it's like, I just want to go by myself. Like I don't, you know, like I do, like I just want to be by myself. So that's so funny. One of the things I'm interested in, and I'm not asking this to be, what's the word I'm looking for? Not contradictory or looking for some kind of, how did you negotiate for your own ethics and your own morals, those conversations with brands? Cause that's something, you know, I do a lot of gear reviews and I have this whole non-sponsored, non-biased thing, and that's my own road, but, and I respect other people in their roads. But I think there's a lot of people who would be interested in those internal because I think you are a guy that has integrity. I don't feel like you're some guy who's just shilling stuff. Do you know what I mean? But you do have relationships with brands, and like representing their products is part of what you do and part of how you create revenue, which I think is completely acceptable. But what are some of those conversations with yourself look like? And what are some things that maybe need to be in place for you to feel comfortable, or some red flags? If you see certain things, you're like, maybe this one's not for me. What does that look like for you?
Yeah, that's a great question. So for me, and I don't know, call it lucky, but it's like, I only work with brands whose products I truly believe in.
Right.
A couple times I've like signed on before I've actually even tried a product. And I very quickly learned that was really stupid because often those products weren't like up to snuff. And so now, and I've kind of always felt this way. It's like, I will only represent a brand's products if it's truly 100% like something I would actually use or I believe in, or that it's like game changing. And, you know, with Sitka gear, that's pretty easy. Matthews Archery, that's pretty easy. I mean, all the bow brands are great, but I work really well with Matthews. Mystery Ranch Backpacks is great. I do some work with Peaks Equipment too. They're great. But with like Peaks, for example, and again, I've already said this, but like all these products or all these brands that reach out, what I do now is I say, hey, like, I appreciate you wanting to work with me. Like, could you send me the product first? And like, let me test it out. Let me test it out for a year. Like, let me really do a deep dive on this and make sure that it's something that I can stand behind and I can put my name behind. Cause you're right. There's a level of integrity, and I don't want to ever do something or promote something that, you know, maybe I didn't give it its full, you know, review or time to figure out maybe its flaws. And so like with Peaks, Bryce, he's the owner of Peaks. He actually came to my door. He lives in Bozeman too, but he came and met me at my house, and he says, hey man, like, we've got this new headlamp. Maybe you want to try it. And I was obviously super skeptical. I was like, yeah, I'll try it out. And previous to that specific headlamp, I was using a Phoenix HL60R. I know you've done some headlamp review stuff, yep, but anyway, yep. To me, that was like the cat's meow. That was the best headlamp out there.
Yep.
One button on and off. It had an 18650 battery. The battery life was really good. It had like 900 lumens, so super bright. Prior to that, I'd used a bunch of like different black diamonds, things that you use AA and AAA batteries. And they just like, they all died so quick, and it was just a pain in the butt. So anyway, so Bryce gives me this, Backcountry Duo is what they call it now. Anyway, I was pretty skeptical. And so I ran it and my Phoenix for basically a year. And I was kind of shocked. I was like, oh, I never actually pulled my Phoenix out ever again. It was like, it just like performed so stinking well. It was super bright. It was way brighter than the Phoenix. It had, I think this early model, it had like a red, green, and a white light. So maybe too many gizmos. But so yeah, it worked really, really well for me. And I put it through its paces for almost a year before Bryce and I had a follow-up and said, like, I was like, hey man, like, this thing's pretty legit. I don't know how you guys got to where you did, but it's pretty awesome. And, you know, if there'd be an opportunity opportunity to work together here, I'd love to do that. So that's how that relationship started. And I would say that's how pretty much all of them start. Often it's a product that I'm already using without a brand, you know, giving it to me. I'm just like, oh, I've just been using this tent or this water filter for years. This is my favorite thing. And then, brand will reach out and be like, hey, like, we love what you do. Like, any chance we could like work together? I'm like, well, I'm already representing your stuff. So absolutely.
It's very encouraging to hear, man. I appreciate that, because I do think sometimes I might come off a bit harsh, or people might misconstrue what I'm saying, and that like nobody should be sponsored ever. And it's like, no, that's not what I'm saying. Like, there are individuals who apply some integrity and, you know, choose who they work with based on some, you know, characteristics that are really important to them. And I think in the best form, like, because I'm kind of coming around a little bit, because sometimes like a whole bunch of people will go out and buy something because I recommended it. And you can't help but think like, oh, it would have been nice to enjoy some of the fruits of that. Do you know what I mean? Like, I created all this video and I just created a bunch of revenue for a company and you don't participate. And I do think if it is an authentic relationship, I don't think there's anything wrong with participating in the benefits of a good product from a good company. Like, there's a handful of companies that I really like. And I even think I'm almost like, I've done so many technical gear reviews now. I think almost what's one of the things that's mattering, at least if not as much, maybe more to me now, is like the ethics and the principles behind the companies themselves. Cause now I'll be at a crossroads where like two companies have like kind of a similar product, but like the way the one company approaches selling it or manufacturing it or dealing with their customers is like really not that favorable. And the other guy, oh, he might be a little bit more expensive, but it's like just the integrity the company has and the way they deal with people. And it's like, okay, so maybe the other one is cheaper or has one more feature or something like this. But this other company just represents, that's the type of people that I want to support, especially in our industry. Like, when we talk about, you know, all the contentious things going on, I think it's really, really important to support companies that are supporting hunting and that have like really good integrity and authenticity. So yeah, thanks for sharing that, because I do think, especially with all the people coming up these days, that's the question I get. It's constant, like, how do I get sponsored? And it's like, man, if that's the first question you're asking, like, it's the wrong question to ask. Like, if you don't just love making content for the sake of making content, go do something else. Because if the only reason you're doing this is to get some free gear, it's going to be a very short-lived, you know, engagement for you. There was another question I was going to ask and now it slipped my mind. How are we doing for time? I got some Instagram questions I wouldn't mind closing out with.
Yeah, no, I'm good for another 15 or 20 minutes probably. Okay, so
perfect. Just let me open this up. Okay, what kind of tips, and I've seen the state of some of your gear, so it's possible you don't have tips for this, but any tips on not destroying camera gear in harsh conditions?
I don't know if this is a tip, but I love shooting in harsh conditions. That's maybe what I'm known for. I don't know. I mean, it all boils back to like me wanting to be in uncomfortable, wild, outdoors, you know, mountain situations. It's like, that's the time you need to be shooting. Like, you don't, when the weather's terrible and it's steep and whatever, it's like, that's when you should be pulling your camera out of your pack and shooting versus putting it back in your pack and not shooting. So my camera gear, also, if someone wants to buy any of my camera gear, I would highly not recommend it because it's been used hard.
I love your little vignette of your camera after the night lapse. And it's just like, my God, man, like, it gives me a heart attack just looking at that thing.
But I mean, when my camera is in my pack, I mean, I don't carry it in any safety protective case, at least on the hunt. If I'm doing air travel, I'll put it in like a Pelican case or something. But yeah, when I'm on the hunt, I usually have one camera on my chest, another one on my shoulder strap. And I'm just like always shooting. And when I do put those cameras in a bag or something, I'll wrap them in clothes, but typically they just go in the top of my backpack and just make sure I'm not dropping my pack on a pile of rocks, but I don't know.
Any particular lens cap, or do you use any particular, I've seen those like little plastic rain sleeves, anything like that?
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a, it's called a, there's a few of them. They're basically a glorified garbage bag that you put over your camera.
It's got a little bit of shape to it, like a bag.
Yeah. It's kind of like a tube too. So you just like push your camera through it. They're like, I think it's a Rugard rain cover. You can get a 2-pack on Amazon for like $5, but yeah, definitely always bring those, and it's definitely a little hack for allowing you to shoot in bad weather. The other thing with that is it's called an air blower. It's just this like silicone tube that you squeeze, and then it puffs out air, like kind of a forced air out of one end. And so you can, hunters maybe have probably used them on like their binoculars and stuff to blow stuff out of their binos, but they're really great for camera gear, or lenses, especially when you get, say, water droplets on your lens, especially if you're in a humid environment, if you're in coastal BC, for example. Yep. If you were to take like a lens cloth and wipe your camera lens, it's just going to smear the heck out of it. So instead you use that air blower and it just blows air, and it just really blows off those water droplets. And so yeah, the little air blower and then those rain covers, that's a two little hacks for shooting in bad weather.
Do you run any particular insurance on your camera gear?
I get the, so I have just general business insurance, which is kind of annoying, because it basically, when I get film permits, I just need proof of insurance. Okay. But then it's kind of annoying because they don't really make insurance, or maybe one of your listeners can inform me here, but to my knowledge, I don't think they make insurance that's kind of like, so the insurance I have, it's more geared for like studio stuff. If someone gets hurt in your studio and it's your fault, it's like, then I would be protected. So, but it's kind of annoying. So I'm like, I don't do any studio work. We're literally out there on hunts. And so, anyway, I do have business insurance, but then also I get, when I buy something new, I usually get like the 2 to 3 year, sometimes they're Allstate, insurance plans. So,
sorry, I got it here. I'm just gonna, so what I seem to be bringing up the wrong. Oh yeah, that's the wrong one. I will send it to you when I'm done. What I actually bought for my A1, I can't remember. It's a third party insurance broker. You got to buy it when your camera is new, but it cost me $750 and it's good for 3 years and there's no additional charge.
Warranty.
Yeah. And it's like, I can drop it off a truck. I can dump it in a lake. I can drop it off of a building, and I just ship them my busted camera and they ship me back. If they can't fix my camera, they replace it.
So I definitely get that. And most people would say that's a waste of money, but when you're out in the elements, it's I'd say it's pretty good use of money. I think I've only broken 3 cameras in my time doing this, but I mean, when it's a, literally in 2 days, they'll ship you pretty much a new one, or we'll fix it for you. So it's worth it.
And I think to it with the, it depends. If you're shooting on a 6500, no, I don't think it makes sense, because you're better off for the once every 2 years, this is going to happen. It's going to be cheaper just to go buy a new camera. But I think when you start getting into like premium full frame gear, where your lenses are costing $2,000 or $3,000 and your bodies are costing $5,000 and $6,000, spending $750 for, you know, three years worth of coverage. And just for the peace of mind, like I don't want to think about, I don't want worrying about my camera to keep me from doing something that might end up capturing some cool content. You know what I mean? What's your favorite Canadian hunt so far? And it's, you've ever just participated in any way, shape or form?
Ooh, probably the winter goat hunt that you and I ran into each other on this year. And the reason why is because, so I'm only 34, but I'm just like, every year that I get older, I just want to make sure that I like, that I still got it, that I'm still like, you know, tough. And so doing that hunt, it's like, it's really cold. It's super snowy. There's avalanche danger. It's steep. It's gnarly. Just like everything about it is just tough, and it's usually quite miserable while you're doing it. But then that entire hunt, I would call it type 2 fun. It's crappy while you're doing it, but really fun to look back on, afterwards. So that one's been a favorite, for sure. So we've killed just a couple of goats. Actually, this year we only left the valley bottom once, like to go up high because avalanche danger was so bad.
Yeah.
We had a big slide come right down, like all the way
to the footage of that is, and I know that bull where you got like, that was not far from camp, man.
Yeah. It was spooky. So we were like, no goats worth dying over. So, I drove all the way up there. So it was like a 40-hour drive to basically hike up a big valley and never really go off the bottom. So, but it's my favorite one. It's just one of the gnarliest things I've done and continue to do every year. So.
There's something so special. Like nothing will ever replace winter goat hunting for me. Yeah. Like to me, it's the ultimate personal challenge. Like I think there's other hunts that are also challenging, but when you throw in those temperatures and those conditions and that terrain, I don't know. It holds a special place. There's nothing else like that. On that note, tips on backcountry skis for up and down access to snowshoe and goat country. This is a great question because I'll give some context here. You guys really opened my eyes because in my head, I had an image of what I thought you'd be able to do on skis. And then I showed up for that area a day or two after you guys showed up. So I'm literally snowshoeing in on your ski trail. And I was like, holy shit. I didn't think you'd be able to do what these guys are doing on skis. So my mini answer to this is that skis are capable of a lot more than you think they are. And the speed with which you guys could cross the more moderate terrain was super impressive. But what kind of tips would you have for somebody who, let's say like me, has only ever snowshoed, but they're looking to add skis into their arsenal? Maybe what's a good place to start, or where would you recommend starting that journey?
Yeah. So again, I mean, I grew up skiing and backcountry skiing a ton. And so I've got a pretty dialed in setup, but yes, skis are incredibly efficient on flat to moderate terrain. You can just cover so much ground. And you're, instead of kind of maybe plowing through snow, like you might do with snowshoes, you kind of glide on top. You need a pair of skis, you need some skins on the bottom, and then you need some sort of binding that allows the heel to lift up and then a boot that will fit into that. And so typically what most people do, Connor and Cam, the other two guys that were on this hunt that we ran into on, they just had just like a backcountry that they call it an AT, an Alpine touring ski setup, to where they had a hard plastic boot that went into a touring binding on a touring ski. And they had a skin on the bottom that allows you to like not slide backwards, only go forward. Problem with that is they also had to bring on this specific hunt, like mountaineering boots so that they could switch into, because, you know, hiking in plastic ski boots can be, it's just kind of hurts, and it's heavy, and it's just not ideal. Also, if you wanted to use snowshoes as well, you'd kind of need maybe like a softer, more plastic, or a not plastic boot. So what I've got is they're 170 centimeter skis with just skins on the bottom. And then the bindings I have on them, these are old binding. They don't even make them anymore. I found a couple pairs off eBay. They're called Silveretta 500s. And what they allow you to do is basically any boot that's got a toe and a heel welt, you know, like that little,
that you need for crampons.
Yeah. As long as it's got a toe and heel one, you can actually mount it in that boot. And so what I did on this winter goat hunt is I just had one pair of boots. I just had a pair of mountaineering boots.
Oh, that's very interesting. Cause I did think you needed two pairs.
Yeah. So just those mountaineering boots with the toe and the heel welt, you know, they're a double boot. So they're super duper warm. They fit into those bindings and it works like cake. They're like, if you were to try to ski downhill in those, it's not ideal. You kind of don't have any control. When you're in a ski boot that's like plastic or like really, really solid and firm, you're going to have a ton of control. But if you're just using it more as an access, trying to get way up river valleys or you know, ski long distances across moderate terrain, it's a pretty awesome setup. So I saved probably 5 or 6 pounds from off of those guys by only bringing one pair of boots.
That's great, man. Yeah, I was impressed with how steep you guys could go up sideways. Like it was almost easier to go up and down for you guys going sideways in the skis than it was for me in the snowshoes. And I was like, I don't know why my brain didn't put two and two together, but I just never imagined that that would be like a way to get around. But you guys were able to go up and around stuff with a lot of agility that I didn't expect to see.
Yeah, so much of hunting and just human powered anything is you're just trying to find the most efficient ways to do stuff. And, you know, say you're using a bicycle, or say like on a winter goat hunt, often the snows, there might be 2 or 3 feet of powder and you're just like, okay, like snowshoes work, but they mostly suck and it's just heavy. And it's like, oh, well, skis would allow you to actually glide on top of that. So we still bring snowshoes just because when you get up in some of that steeper stuff, like, it's just frankly kind of dangerous. Or if you're like climbing up through just like, say, a bunch of willows or alders and stuff, it's like you can't ski up that, you can't navigate that. So we would also bring the snowshoes. We'd also bring crampons too. So the old winter hunt ends up bringing a lot.
Yeah,
of
I use my crampons more this year than any other year. And I realized I used to have this like friction, this mental friction about switching between my crampons and my snowshoes. And I would end up wasting a lot of time going through crampon areas in snowshoes because like, I just didn't want to stop and dunk my pack. And this year I was like, okay, just stop that. As soon as your mode of transportation is inefficient, switch them out. Even if it's only for 100 yards. And then if it mellows out afterwards and you can switch back, then switch back. And I noticed in hindsight, I was way more efficient. Just like, go back and forth, man, if you need to. But if the terrain is dictating a crampon instead of a snowshoe, then just switch. Because even in some of that deeper stuff, when you're in the windfall, I was making way better time in the crampons because I wasn't getting caught up and under stuff and I didn't have this big, long snowshoe. And so I was still post-holing, but actually, because it was so steep and so much windfall, making much better time in the crampons than the snowshoes. Yeah, it was really interesting. Okay, one last question. I remember the question I was going to ask, and this is purely selfishly driven as another content creator. One of the things I really like about your content is like your little vignettes. It could be something as simple as making a cup of coffee or doing a little bit of archery practice outside of the camper in New Mexico. Like these really like basic normal things, but you turn them into like these 30 to 90 second, and maybe this is influenced by Nystat because he's also kind of like the king of this, but they're beautiful. Do you know what I mean? Like they're shot really well. They're shot really interesting. I wouldn't say you do a bunch of like technical gimmicky editing. It's like clean editing. I always tell myself when I'm headed out, I'm going to record those kinds of things. And then I get rushed, or I think it's not going to be important enough, or nobody's going to care. Anyways, I come up with a bunch of excuses, or maybe it's just lack of technical skill. I would be interested in how you approach just the art of like shooting one of those. Is it something you think about really in depth, or you just capture a bunch of footage and then decide what you're going to do with when you get home? But I'd love to hear you talk about that for a little bit before we close out.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess on one hand, it's like, okay, how can I increase the production value? How can I make this more entertaining for viewers? And then secondly, it's kind of like, it, especially with video, it's good to be a little bit intentional, especially when you're doing maybe like shooting these little segments. So maybe it's like you say, making coffee in the morning or like shooting the bow or just kind of, it's like, sweet, I want to do this like 10-second little bit of this cool thing happening with some sweet music. And it just kind of like shows the progress of the day and shows just kind of like all the stuff that goes into it. I guess because otherwise, it for me anyway, it just ends up just being a talking to the camera segment.
100%, man. 100%. So
it's like, oh, how do you mix that up? How do you make it more engaging, more interesting to the people watching your stuff? So I think it's as simple as that.
Okay. All right. Anything you want to add before we close out? Anything you got coming up that you want to draw people's attention to?
Oh boy. Well, the life of a freelance photographer and videographer is you never quite know what you're going to be getting yourself into because you're kind of at the mercy of brands and the people you shoot for. So I don't know. I would like to be like, oh, my whole year is already planned out, but that never happens. But some cool potential things on the docket. I might be going up to, actually my wife and I both might be going up to Dustin Rowe's outfit. So he's got a
place. The new one?
Well, he's got a place in BC and the one in the Yukon. And so
yeah.
I'm not sure where we'll end up, okay. but we'll probably go up there for a month this summer, which would be really cool.
Oh, that'd be amazing. Either one of those would be outstanding.
Yeah,
I'd love to go up. Yeah. He's in some really cool, I'm going to be not right beside, but in not too far, doing a fly-in caribou goat archery hunt in September.
Nice. Rad,
that's going to be in some of his similar terrain. All right. Well, for everybody listening, I'm going to include links to all of Steven's stuff in the show notes. So YouTube, Instagram, all that stuff. I would highly recommend subscribing to the YouTube channel specifically, because I think whether you're just enjoying watching, in fact, one of the comments was, I don't have a question, but please ask him to make more content because I like it. And I was like, he's probably just a friction between paid work for clients and how much of my own, you know, vlog content can I actually have the time to put together. But I know there's a lot of people that want to make content. And I think by watching individuals like yourself, who've done a really good job of like having a consistent narrative while still having like a high, interesting, artistic production value without turning it into some like overly produced garbage that none of us really enjoy, I think you're a really good example. So I would highly recommend subscribing to Steven's YouTube channel for that. But other than that, man, I've been waiting to have this conversation for a while. And then when I ran into you guys, I'm like, okay, I just got to reach out because that was far too much of a coincidence. So thanks again for taking the time, man. I greatly appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you, Jay. Thanks for having me, and good luck on your September hunt.
Yeah. Thank you very much, man. Cheers.